Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1 with It's for Women. The car insurance with extra benefits like personal accident cover.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Life is such a precious thing. Why don't we get more of it? Those are the words of the late Christopher Robson, who was a central figure in Irish LGBT activism, helping found the Dublin Lesbian and Gay Men's Collectives, Gay Health Action, and GLEN, the Gay and Lesbian Equality Network. Well, a photography exhibition that charts Ireland's journey towards LGBT equality is now running at the National Photographic Archive in Dublin. And his civil partner and one of the founders of Gay Health Action is Bill Foley, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now in studio. Morning, Bill. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Miriam. Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here. Listen, can I begin with how you and Christopher met? I believe it was at a cheese and wine party in the late 1970s.
Yes. Subsequently called a cheesy and wine parties. Yes, it was the Irish gay rights movement in the 70s were the main organisation at the time. And there was a big focus on kind of facilitating social engagement between people as much as activism. And one of the things that they did was a monthly cheese and wine party, which is on Sunday afternoon. So it was complete with cocktail sticks and pineapple hedgehogs and things like that, all sorts of things that were fairly tacky. But it was a great way to meet people outside of the pub scene and to get to know people very well. And I turned up one day in 1978 to see that Christopher was there, and a very attractive man, immediately attracted to him. And I went up and chatted to him almost immediately.
And is it true you were almost wearing similar shirts?
It was the line I used to chat him up was because he was wearing a shirt that I had seen in the window of FX Kelly, which was a very posh shop at the top of Grafton Street at the time. And it was slightly beyond my reach. So I saw that he was wearing it and wearing it very well, a bright check coloured shirt. So I went up and complimented on it, and it all started from there. It was funny because we started a kind of immediate banter. It was an immediate click between us. You know, when that happens, sometimes you just have an instant rapport. And I remember part of the conversation was me explaining to him about photography, because there was a photograph in the room that was kind of quirky. And he was kind of explaining to me about dancing and the importance of dance when I was at the time winning disco dancing competitions. So it was kind of later in the evening, we kind of had a great laugh about it because he saw me dancing in the disco club. And then I went back home to his place where the place was festooned with his amazing photography. So it was hilarious that we were trying to outdo each other in each other's fields from the beginning.
Was it tricky in the late 70s? I mean, it's not that long ago, really. But I mean, society was different. Was it tricky to be out and gay in the late 1970s or not?
Yes. I mean, one of Christopher's phrases about it was in a way that everything was forbidden, so everything was allowed, in the sense that, you know, it was very hard for people to be prosecuted against things because there were so many areas to do it. Not that prosecutions or arrests didn't happen, they did, and there was quite a lot of kind of vigilance by the guards around the clubs, for instance, in Parnell Square and so on, and a lot of people were arrested and so on. In cruising areas. So it was an intimidating environment. And obviously it was the 1970s, so you still had the dominance of the Catholic Church. The idea of thinking outside the box in terms of your own sexuality was very difficult to do. Christopher had his own difficult passage in coming out because he was older than I was by about 17 years. So he grew up in, I suppose, not that different conservative atmosphere, but certainly different enough. And he had kind of attended psychiatrists and so on because of the depression and so on, I think largely related to that. So he came out at the age of 35. So it was a very difficult process for some people to acknowledge it. You know, I was 17 when I came out. So from
where did you get your confidence and courage to do it so young? Because 17 would have been, is young today, but would have been very young then,
yeah,
to come out.
Yeah, it was unusual. Well, I think it was very clear to me that I wasn't sexually attracted to women. And once I realized that, I began to explore what the other options were, and found Bartley Dunn's, which was the pub at the time, and the Irish gay rights movement, which were kind of a lifesaver to be able to kind of have those to support you.
And how were your parents when that happened?
Christopher and I met in 78 and we were still not out to our families by that stage. And a few years later, we were kind of strangely becoming to be a bit known as a long-term gay couple. And we did some radio interviews and newspaper interviews about it, even though we were only together 2 years. So it just goes to show what constituted a long-term relationship back then. We were also beginning to get involved in activism. And so some publicity around it was coming out, and we were involved in the Fairview March, the organising of that. And when that got a huge amount of publicity, we realised, good heavens, our families might see us on television and find out that way. So we both kind of came out to our respective parents as a result of the Fairview March and the publicity that gained. And when Christopher told his parents, they reacted by saying, oh, you should have told us earlier, we'd have come on the march with you, which I thought was amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely perfect response to a coming out story.
And your own?
My own were slightly different. My father was a very conservative, traditional Catholic man. And when I told him, he just reacted very badly and told me never to visit the house again and so on. My mother was upset, but much more supportive about it. And I began to visit the family home while my dad wasn't there. And then it was a bit like the Northern Ireland proximity talks later, where I'd be in one room with some of the family and he'd be in another. And then eventually he kind of came around. I mean, I'm very happy to say that in later life we became friends, and actually he got to know Christopher so well, and we were away on city breaks and so on throughout our lives, that he wrote separate Christmas cards to Christopher, kind of thanking him for his, you know, being in the family and his contribution.
That's so nice,
to
isn't it.
It was lovely.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
And of course, you were like, the Fairview March, was that because of the Declan Flynn's murder? So in other words, you both got very involved in activism and things like even Gay Health Action.
Yeah. So it all started really with the Dublin Lesbian and Gay Men's Collectives, which was founded in about 1981 or 82. And by then, Cork Gay Collective had organised a national conference in Cork. And we met around then, and there was a group of people in Dublin keen to kind of continue the idea of a national LGBT conference annually. So in 81, there was a Dublin conference, and the group of us that were involved in that kind of came together to form the collectives. And then that group of people were the ones who organised the Declan Flynn March, because, you know, in that judgment, the judge had said this could never be regarded as murder, because the defence was that it was killing a gay man. And so there was outrage. There was national outrage, actually, at the time. And we were obviously very furious and angry and upset. And so we made the decision to march on Fairview Park. And that's where, you know, a lot of things happened and evolved from there.
And Christopher's role with Glenn, the Gay and Lesbian Equality Network, it was really important. You know, he had his amazing letter writing skills, his activism here along with others. You feel it really helped lead to important pieces of legislation, don't you, Bill?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like, Glenn was the perfect organisation for Christopher. He was articulate, he was elegant, he was a very easy person to know and to like. He had come up through the civil service system in Ireland, so he knew how to write memos and to kind of argue for points. And when he brought that skill into lobbying and to letter writing and to meetings with politicians, it was hugely influential. And there's a whole series of pieces of legislation, I believe, that wouldn't be in place without his involvement. In particular, it started with the trade union movement, actually, and all of us who had jobs and were in unions at the time. Again, it was a difficult time for a lot of people in terms of unemployment. But we had a campaign of putting amendments through our AGMs in the trade union to include sexual orientation as a non-discrimination kind of feature of the policies, which culminated in an ICTU guideline. And then that was then put into the employment equality legislation, again, largely at Christopher's kind of actions through Glenn with the lobbying letters he created around that. So it was very significant pieces of legislation. Obviously, it ultimately led to law reform in 93, and then we had civil partnership in 2010, and subsequently after he died, there was the Equal Marriage Act came in 2015. But he had written kind of strategic papers in terms of how to get there from quite early on with Glenn. So I think his influence is huge in all of those spheres.
And his influence on you too, Bill, because I know you're still involved in Health Action. Like, I think last night you were even with people from Empower. I think they work in gay bars and clubs testing people and teaching them about HIV.
That's right. I mean, it's one of the great groups I'm involved in at the moment. And it's wonderful to be able to bring testing into the community. I mean, part of the battle against the rising number of HIV cases in Ireland is to facilitate ease of access to testing, and Empower is a very significant part of that. Unfortunately, Ireland is one of the countries in the Western world where HIV is still rising, and we are, you know, part of the program to try and prevent that. There is in other countries a PrEP program, which is post-exposure or pre-exposure prophylaxis, which means that it's a medication people can take to prevent them from becoming HIV infected. And in other countries where this program is widely distributed, the rates of reduction of HIV are staggering. You know, Ireland, unfortunately, is still going the opposite direction, even though PrEP has been introduced here a couple of years ago, but it isn't as widely available as it should be. So there's a lot more work to be done on that. And Empower and so on will be playing its part in all of that.
Now, as you mentioned, Christopher, he died actually in 2013. I think it was just days, Bill, after your civil partnership. That was obviously an incredibly tough time.
Yeah, I mean, it's horrendous looking back on it, how fast it all was, because he had got this strange bone disease in the year before he died, in 2012, and he was asked to rest. It was a kind of necrotizing kind of illness of his knee. And we had normally done very big holidays abroad and so on, and we were going to go to Southeast Asia, but that was clearly not going to be feasible with the way his leg was working. And so we went on a very simple holiday to Spain, kind of beach drinking, reading kind of holiday. And it was while there he began to have some odd symptoms. He went off his food, he began to have nosebleeds, he was very weak and tired. And so as soon as he came back, I kind of insisted he go to the doctor immediately. And unfortunately, there was a problem with liver function. And I suppose there was a sequence of testing events that we were kind of hoping would go positive. But each time it was the worst possible scenario that came back. So instead of it just being a self-righting kind of liver problem, it turned out to be a tumor. Instead of being a tumor that could be operated on, it turned out to be inoperable. Instead of being focused on one site, it was multifocused. Instead of, you know, reacting to medication, it was resistant to all that. So it was incredibly rapid. And like, he had had the diagnosis towards the middle or end of January. And by the time March came around, the end of March came around, he had died. So it was just really fast. And it was shocking for that, because I think in your opening statement, you'd made a remark about how kind of in love with life he was. Mm. I mean, he was himself an incredible life force. I remember one story he told me about, you know, trees live to be 1,000 and people only get to be 70 or 80. And that's so unfair. And so for me, the idea of a world without Christopher seemed literally inconceivable. You know, he was such a force. So it was an absolutely horrendous time when he died. I mean, I just couldn't believe it.
So sorry about that, Bill. But look, he left you and Ireland with this extraordinary archive of photographs documenting change in Ireland, which in the week we're in, which is Pride. But you donated them, didn't you?
So, yeah. Yes, I mean, he had taken photographs of Pride from 93 onwards. I mean, in the early days of our activism, obviously bringing a camera around anywhere wouldn't have been the done thing. But in 1992, he went to a conference in Paris, the International Lesbian and Gay Association conference there. And while at that conference, he was taking photographs of Paris, obviously, but he was also taking photographs of the conference scenes. And there was a decision by the conference to protest against at the Mexican embassy against the discriminatory actions they were having against gay men in Mexico at the time. And during that demonstration, a peaceful demonstration, they were attacked by the police, and various activists were injured, including Kieran Rose, a very well-known LGBT activist here. And Christopher continued to take photographs. Now Christopher was the mildest of men and would kind of run a mile from an argument normally. But he must have steeled himself in a particular way in order to take those photographs, and they're in the exhibition.
And the great thing is that that exhibition is currently running at the National Photographic Archive in Temple Bar, and it's open for all and free to visit. It's a wonderful, you know, reminder of his greatness. And Bill, thanks so much for taking the time to come in to us this morning.
Thank you very much, Miriam. It's great. And the exhibition is now open 7 days, so 10 to 4, 7 days a week. So it's open on weekends.
Brilliant.
Now. It wasn't originally. But thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about him today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Bill. We'll take a break, bringing some of the reaction to our interview there with Bill. Hi, Miriam. I knew Christopher Robinson. And he was a really lovely, erudite person. Always a pleasure to meet and talk to. And one more from Linda Cullen. So lovely to hear Bill Foley with Miriam and RT there. Talk about his wonderful partner, Christopher Robson, and his incredible archive. RIP, dear Chris. Sadly missed.